This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast, and in this episode we're going to rethink a little bit the famous Solzhenitsyn book, The Gulag Archipelago, and see if we can come up with some new interpretations on the idea of the Gulag system within the Soviet Union, because there is a raft of modern writing on the subject which looks at it from a variety of different perspectives. The Second World War. Solzhenitsyn, in February 1945, whilst in East Prussia, was arrested by the Soviet secret police for making a comment about Stalin and his conduct of the war in a letter to a friend. He was accused of anti-Soviet propaganda under Article 58 of the Soviet Criminal Code, and given a lengthy jail sentence. He was taken to the Lubyanka prison, where he was interrogated, and after being sentenced in absentia, he was given an 8-year jail sentence in a Soviet labour camp. Following Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956, Solzhenitsyn was freed, he was exonerated, and returned home, and in 1960, with the express permission of Khrushchev, his first book, A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, an account of life in the Gulag, was picked up by Novy Mir magazine, and then 2 years later in 62, again with Khrushchev's blessing, was published. It was read in schools. Khrushchev, when he was questioned on this, said there was a Stalinist in all of us and this evil must be rooted out. And it was part of Khrushchev's wider policy to differentiate himself from Stalin and to present a different view of the Soviet Union. The thaw, which began in 1956, ultimately brought about a degree of chaos that the party old guard didn't like, and it was one of the reasons for Khrushchev's downfall in 1965. By the time the Gulag Archipelago had been published in 1973, The Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich had done its work. It was an enormously important work of fiction that, obviously a fiction based on realities, that had sent shockwaves around the world and had a significant role to play in discrediting the last aspects of the Soviet Union, which had been lauded by the foreign fellow traveller movement throughout the 1930s to the 1950s. And anything possibly progressive about the Soviet Union that people had mistakenly latched onto and thought really was solid and coherent, certainly transpires after reading Denisovich not to not be that. The Gulag Archipelago was a history of the camps, and it in its various sections it traced the development of the system from 1918 to 1956, looking at the original orders of Lenin to set up a system of incarceration for political prisoners and troublemakers, and looks at the development of the system throughout Stalin. For the time, it's a really important book, but there are now revisionist ideas which suggest that the notion itself of it being an archipelago is slightly outdated based on what we now understand. So if we were to consider the analogy for one moment, the camps are dotted like small islands across the Soviet Union, but when an individual wound up in a camp, they were not quite as hermetically sealed from the rest of the Soviet Union as it might first appear. They were not essentially stuck on an island. The publication of the Gulag Archipelago offered a damning indictment of the Soviet regime and created this mental map that has really dominated most of the scholarly and popular works on the subject ever since. If you imagine that the secrecy surrounding the Soviet camps and their separateness and their geographical and physical remoteness from anything that people, not just in the West, but even in Russia, were able to physically deal with. And the compare that to the other system that was far more accessible to people in the post-war era, the Nazi system of camps, which following the defeat of Nazi Germany were largely there and open and on display, and most of the secrets surrounding them had been swept away. It did encourage people to embrace this idea of the archipelago, of the notion that it was a closed system that wasn't discussed in wider Soviet society. And once an individual was stuck into it, that they devoured and were never seen again. Our mental map for the gulags was essentially the camps of the Nazis, because so little was known about the gulags that there was only one equivalent, and it was, you know, as taken as read that the Nazi camps and the Soviet camps must be rather similar. Well, actually not. Now, I've been reading an article in the 2015 summer edition of Critica magazine by the academic David Shearer on the Soviet Gulag system, the Soviet Gulag and Archipelago. So what I'm getting here is drawn from this writing. And what David Shearer has done is done a literature review of a number of different writers on the subject of the gulags. Now, I can't I haven't got the time, basically, in this podcast to go through everything that's said on the topic of the revision to the notion of the Gulag Archipelago, but I'm going to try and give you some of the highlights, because it is really important. And the way in which we think about the camps is constantly evolving and emerging, because new evidence is coming to light. So instead of the camps being an archipelago, new metaphors are being coined to talk about the very fluid and dynamic relationship between the camps and the rest of Soviet society. So the revolving door or the porous boundary is a much more accurate way of looking at the camp. Prisoners it's quite possible to have several sentences in the camps where one might have a 5-year spell 18 months outside the camps, then re-arrest and re-incarceration for another 7 years and perhaps have another 5 year sentence on top of that. One of the absurdities of Stalinism was pointed out by Michel Foucault, the historian and philosopher of ideas, who spent a lot of time thinking about the development of prisons and incarceration. And Foucault pointed out that there was a kind of an absurdity about a worker's state that used labour both to define citizenship, i.e. How valid a kind of citizen you were, dependent on the kind of work you actually did, and also a form of punishment. And there was a blatant contradiction between the goals and reality of Soviet penal practice, i.e. that there was supposedly a redemptive purpose of labour, i.e. that labour had a transformative quality, and that a bad kind of individual could be put into the camp system at one end, and through the application of hard physical labour, a redeemed proletarian soul could emerge at the other end. However, the reality, of course, in this redemptive labour often killed large numbers of the people that it was applied to. The a different way of looking at labour in the camps is actually a kind of a far more Marxist one. The Marxist idea of profit is that profit comes from surplus labour value, i.e. if somebody produces £10 or $10 of value through their labour in an hour, by simply paying them $5 or £5, you walk away with $5 of pounds worth of profit. Well, the Soviet system did that on a vast scale. It was a system for extracting labour value from workers by paying them, by enslaving them, paying them nothing, half starving them, and simply sucking the labour value quite literally out of their bodies. I suppose it's rather fitting in a perverse and monstrous way that dictators like Lenin and Stalin, steeped in Marxist theory and with a detailed understanding of Marxist economics, applied these notions in the most brutal way possible. It's worth saying here that this is probably not what Karl Marx had intended. The camps were captured for the first time in 1934 by a group of writers and artists led by Maxim Gorky, who by this time had really sold himself to the Bolsheviks and become their laureate. The photographer Alexander Rodchenko created, along with Gorky, the notion of Perekovka, the idea of a myth of reforging, which I just talked about there, redemption through labour.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalised plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And they claimed that Petakovka was the basis of the Soviet labor camp system. They wrote the Soviet equivalent of a coffee table book, the Stalin White Sea Baltic Sea Canal, the Belomor Canal, in which police officials such as Yagoda, the head of the NKVD, were treated as kinds of heroes. Their heroism was based around the idea that they had become kind of engineers of the human condition, that they were reforming men and women through their labour and rescuing them from bad pre-revolutionary behaviours that in their eyes had been learned through the kind of the wicked and iniquitous world of capitalism. And there were Soviet officials that believed in this. There were Soviet officials and probably indeed camp guards that on some level believed that they were trying to redeem individuals. However, the system itself was not designed with this in mind. If it happened to be a byproduct of the Soviet system, then fine. But it was not designed with this goal at its heart. Instead, it was designed, as mentioned, as a vast sort of labour extraction system. The pioneer of this system, its father really, was Naftali Frenkel. Naftali Frenkel, Alexander Solzhenitsyn believed, was a Turkish Jew from Constantinople, who seemed to have been caught up in the revolution somewhere and wound up as a prisoner in the Sovoletsky Islands. He was arrested in 1923 for illegally crossing borders. Nobody knows quite what that means. He could have been a smuggler or some kind of merchant, and given a 10-year sentence of hard labour in the Sovoletsky Islands in the White Sea, which becomes the first camp system of the Gulag. It was the system that all of the gulags were roughly based around. He rose quickly from being a prisoner to being a staff member on the strength, basically, of his proposal that the camp administration link inmates' food rations to their rate of production, something that was rolled out through all camps throughout the Gulag system until really the 1950s. What Frenkel manages to do to pull strings and give himself this kind of advantage, no one really knows, and the story of Frenkel is lost in a lot of mythology. But supposedly when he arrived in the Solovetsky Islands and saw how much waste was engendered, how much potential revenue the island camp was losing out on, he was able to show, in the manner of a kind of a skilled capitalist, that the industries that existed there, which were forestry, farming and brickmaking, could be made so much better and could generate badly needed revenue for the state. Yagoda, curiously, came to see him and suddenly realised that he was onto something. Supposedly, Frenkel actually was taken to Moscow to speak with Stalin and Kaganovich. How much of this, again, is myth-making, it's difficult to know. But Frenkel emerged as one of the camp's commanders. Solzhenitsyn said, again, that he created the eat-as-you-work system, which resulted in the deaths of weaker prisoners who slid down the scale very quickly, and the prisoners who were able to work hard were the ones that survived. The historian of the Gulag, Anne Applebaum, says, "Even if Frenkel did not invent every aspect of the system, he did find a way to turn a prison camp into an apparently profitable economic institution, and he did so at a time, in a place, and in a manner which may well have brought the idea to the attention of Stalin." The historian Golfo Alexopoulos argues that there is no redemptive quality to the Soviet camp system, and that, as Solzhenitsyn has argued, its primary role was the destruction of individuals. It was the exploitation of human beings by wringing every ounce of work from them, and the reason why there were frequent amnesties and frequent releases of thousands of prisoners were that these were the prisoners that were no longer any use. They were weakened or dying, and they had no labour left within them, no physical strength left within them to contribute. So it's important to get these net consumers of resources off the balance sheet of the camp as quickly as possible, dump them back into society where they can wither away and die, or not, who cares, and get in fresh labour as quickly as possible. The camp system operates more like a kind of Dickensian workhouse, or far worse, in fact, than anything that the workhouses ever came up with. And it paradoxically, for a socialist institution or an organ of a notionally socialist state, a more ruthless system of labour exploitation could not possibly have been dreamt up of, even in the kind of the exploiting capitalist world. It really is the absolute kind of epitome of labour value extraction. Labour is only extracted at a higher rate in the death camps of the Nazi regime that double up as labour camps as well, specifically Auschwitz-Birkenau, where the inmates had a lifespan of 3 months. And this is because the camp has a purpose, the Nazi camps have the purpose of systems of labour extraction, but also of factories of genocide as well. The fact that the prisoners were Jewish and were earmarked for annihilation anyway as quickly as possible meant that if some labour could be extracted from them in the meantime, this was a good thing. But the genocidal element was the real end game. In 1934, major changes happened to the police state. It's reorganised from being simply a political police force searching out class enemies and protecting the revolution into providing security for the state itself. This was now the institutions that controlled the Gulag system, and they were no longer there to fight for revolution, but to protect institutions that were now established. And this sees, after 1934, a significant decline in the supposed redemptive quality of the camps. Instead, the camps are simply seen as places for the destruction of enemies or the utilisation of the labour of enemies. And because it was decided after 1934 that rehabilitation was no longer possible and that rehabilitation was no longer desirable and simply society needed to be protected from bad elements, that the bad elements, such as kulaks, when their sentences were finished, were told that they would not be allowed to go home to the communities that they had come from. Instead, that they now had to be moved to special areas, so that when they were allowed out of the gulags, being sent off to special areas meant that they existed in almost like a parallel camp system. And it's the transition between the special areas, or special settlements as they're known, and cities that the former inmates are allowed into, and sometimes the shift of reincarceration back into the camp system that creates this semi-permeable membrane between the camps and the wider world. It was difficult to actually step back into normal life, really, until the Khrushchev thaw of the 1950s. But there was a kind of a grey zone between the camps and the rest of Russian society that former inmates were able to exist in. It was not a particularly pleasant existence. It was perhaps mildly better than the camps, but certainly still fairly miserable, and one with all manner of restrictions, forced labour, and the chance, with one false word, to wind up back in the camps once again. So, just to recap, the original picture of the Gulag Archipelago was massively influential and important and a real eye-opener for the rest of the world on the nature of the camps, perhaps needs to be revised in order to look at contemporary research and realities which show that instead of the Gulag Archipelago existing, a revolving door between the Gulag system and the rest of Russian society did appear to be there. Anyway, thanks for this, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. If you can give us a review on iTunes, that'd be great, and also keep an eye out for our Patreon page. Thanks, all the best, bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.